Hello everyone, you're listening to The Culture is Black, a quarterly podcast series dedicated to spotlighting Black businesses and Black creatives. This show is brought to you by Cork, the UK's leading influencer intelligence and digital trend forecasting agency. I'm Jennifer Adetoro, a culture writer and journalist. For so long, Black businesses and Black creatives have set the tone of wider mainstream culture. Now in 2020 and the decade ahead, we as a society are having bigger conversations about the need for equity for Black talent. This podcast aims to facilitate some of these much-needed conversations, all while showcasing the rising talent, the entrepreneurs, and the trailblazers who deserve the spotlight. Throughout this series, I'll be your host, but I won't be doing this alone. You'll be hearing from other journalists who will be taking part in hosting the conversation. So, let's get into it. In this week's episode, we dive deep into the arts and culture sector. In 2015, it was reported that performing artists contributed $5.4 billion a year to the economy. However, the pandemic has had a substantial impact on this space, and we've seen numerous jobs at major cultural institutions become threatened, and many of these same venues have been forced to shut down. And while Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden pledged $1.57 billion to help the arts through the government's Culture Recovery Fund, this can only do so much. With the initiative primarily focused on helping a set list of institutions, this leaves many freelancers, who make up a large amount of workers in this space, vulnerable. Hoping to see more support in this field is multi-award-winning poet, playwright and performer Inawar Ellums. You might know him best for his play The Barbershop Chronicles, which sold out two runs at the National Theatre. Journalist Carlene Thomas-Bailey caught up with the creative to discuss the future of theatre, online communities and poetry.
First up, how on earth have you found lockdown?
I guess no different to most people. Actually, no. I say that from a privileged point of view because there are a lot of people who worked right through lockdown because they had no other choice. Mm-hmm. There are the people taking the tubes, which from the privilege of our, you know, computer desk job, home life, could talk, and we did so before we realized what we're doing. So like most people in my industry, we were worried. We were tired, we were afraid, we were exhausted, we were overstimulated, and terrified about all our collective futures. And I think a lot of those fears were justified and will be deepened in the coming months. Like most people, I was shocked and I was numbed into silence and into stillness. I'm quite a sociable person. I'm either giving performances or hosting events or curating events. And not being able to do so was really difficult because I was left alone with my thoughts in my flat. Yeah. And I was fortunate enough to have really good relationships with my neighbors. We all have a WhatsApp group, so we're sort of emotionally supporting, which was really lovely. So I didn't experience how bad this must have been for most Londoners. Financially wise, I lost about 70% of my income. Wow. This year. Harsh to take, but it could be a lot worse. And slowly, some other little bits of writing work began to seep in, and I'd be able to work that way. But a lot of my work was indefinitely postponed, some completely cancelled.
Wow, so a lot going on. I guess I kind of want to go back to a bit of the start, because I actually saw you at an event in London where you were talking about the Midnight Run event series that you do. Yeah. And then obviously there's some people who know you from the Barbershop Chronicles, which is amazing, your play that was on at the National Theatre. And then obviously you do loads of other different things. So I wanted to start with, like, what one of those things do you define yourself? Would you say you're like full-time poet, side hustle, playwright, or are you just like under the umbrella of all those things?
I think predominantly I'm a poet. That's all I really want to do and all I care about. Most of the time, I go to sleep thinking about poetry and wake up thinking about poetry. Now and then, I get big ideas and it becomes other things like plays or film scripts or TV series. And I'm working on a couple of those right now. But most of the time, I'm just interested in precise uses and beautified uses of language in order to explain who we are, where we have come from, and why we are the way we are. And poetry is those things to me, and provides all of those outlets and spaces for reflection and understanding and meditation. But also, because of who I am, and by that I mean my race, my background, my ethnicity, my nationality. A lot of my work exists in socio-political spheres. Therefore, my work branches out and I cover a broad spectrum of spaces, really. And all of those is manifest in the Midnight Run, which essentially creates a safe space for adults to play, to migrate through an urban space, and to do so without thinking about identity necessarily, without thinking about financial hurdles, because it's all walking based and all you have to do is be able to carry your own weight. And we try to keep the prices to a minimum so that it doesn't exclude people from our communities. Yeah, but primarily all I want to do is write poetry.
Amazing. And I was just thinking, you know, everything you were saying there about kind of like race and class and gender and all of that. When you came to the realization that poetry was it for you, how difficult was that? But maybe it wasn't difficult at all. But, you know, I kind of look at like Black British history and you have someone like a Benjamin Zephaniah. And then there's this like kind of new wave of like you and George the Poet. But traditionally, poetry wasn't really a career. And so I'm just really interested in how you navigated that for yourself in terms of like being okay with that decision and really embracing it and loving it. And then also how everyone around you responded to that decision.
I'm not entirely sure if poetry is a career. If all I did was write poetry, I don't think I'd have a roof over my head,
right,
as I do now. It's because I do a whole heap of other things that I'm able to afford this 2-bedroom, 2-bathroom flat in South London and pay my mortgage on my own. I'm a first generation immigrant, I am an immigrant. I left when I was 12. So to be able to have achieved all of this and, you know, to be on London's property ladder, yeah, none of that would have been possible if I solely wrote poetry. And I only started writing because there was nothing else that I could do. Because of how tight money was and because of my nationality, I could not go to university. I would have been classed as an international student. We should have placed a £10,000 price tag on my education per year. And I had no recourse to government grants or loans or anything, or student loans or anything like that. Therefore, I started writing because the artistic flair that I was born with, which I'd nursed since my childhood, needed an outlet. And because I couldn't afford paint and paintbrushes, but I could get paper freely and pens were readily available, I just started writing. And it just grew and grew from there. And my parents still wanted me to go to university and to learn one of the accepted trades for Nigerian households, which is to become a doctor or a lawyer or any of those typical jobs. But my father came to my first book launch in 2005. When he saw a man older than he was queuing for my autograph was when he began to relax a little bit.
That's nice.
And by the time that we got the rights to live and work indefinitely in this country in 2011, I'd already been working as a poet for 8 years or so. And my name was sort of established. My play had opened at the National Theatre the year before. And my parents just knew that I could make enough money to look after myself and contribute to the household. So they began to just let me keep on going. And I think I am 17 years deep into my so-called career right now. And it's all I've ever done. The only other job I had was as an office boy in an architectural firm in Dublin, where I lived for 3 years. And then 2 months working at JJB Sports in Ireland. And I spent most of that time in the back room throwing beanbags at my colleagues. So I've been a self-employed artist ever since.
Amazing. But see, I think it's really important to tell those sorts of stories because one, I think you can, you know, look at social media now, for example, and think, okay, he just kind of glowed up. He came out of nowhere and just like made it. And I think it's really important to talk about like what went before and what was the lead up to the level of hustle, the level of work that it took. But I'm also really interested in how, because obviously there's quite a lot going on about discussions very important about race, and I wonder how you were embraced by, I'd say, like kind of historical heritage artistic outlets in terms of like the big theatres, the smaller theatre scene, in terms of being able to really nurture your craft and build on it. What was it like? Were you banging on doors at the beginning, or was it all did it all come quite seamlessly?
I want to say that I hustled hard and I networked like hell. But the truth is, I'm terrible at networking. And because then I'm an immigrant, I spent quite a good chunk of my life being chased out of the countries that I tried to live in. I'm highly sensitive to hostile spaces.
Yeah.
If ever I found myself in places that wasn't wanted, I just move, I just go. So I never try to hustle too hard to get into spaces. And if I wasn't wanted, I just move on. But what I did was I found great collaborators and a great producer, and they became the spokespeople who championed my work and had conversations with theaters on my behalf.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they had as much to benefit as I did. If they were creating my work or reaching audiences, they would seem to have been groundbreaking or was financially viable to them and to me, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But they did a lot of hustling with regards to my theater work.
Mm-hmm.
And my poetry work, I just went to open mics and read and read and read until different opportunities and spaces came up, and I performed there and my work began to travel. I maintained a healthy poetry mailing list,
mm-hmm.
and social media also helped because I was easily contactable. And also, I think I'm quite personable. And though I never shy away from politics, there was something else that governed or underlined my work, which meant that a piece of work, a poem, could be interpreted into, I don't know, five or so different themes or subject matter, which meant that other people had different entry points into my work. And I think that just became a mark, a brand for the kind of things that I create. And it just grew from there. So I'm a huge believer in the universe creating space for you as long as you listen to it and listen to your heart. And that has stayed me well over the years throughout my career, really. So I'm not a great networker. I'm not a great hustler or anything like that. I just try to be honest with myself and the people I'm collaborating with and trust that the universe will guide me.
That's really nice. I like that. And I was just thinking, actually, as you were talking there, do you think that coming up in the age of social, we've spoken to different people for this podcast in terms of like music and fashion in other episodes, and I think they've all come up in the age of social, and I wondered to the level that you think it's helped. Like, for example, I was looking at your newsletter, and there's all these like avenues to you, which is really useful. So you can find out, okay, you know, you've got this new book of poems coming out on October 5th, or, you know, you got the kind of Hay Festival medal for poetry. Do you think that like being able to build digital online communities has really supported your growth as well, I guess?
I think so. I think it has to a certain extent, because especially for people of color, a lot of places in the West have been historically and continue to be hostile to us and the kinds of work we create. And Black Twitter made Twitter, if we really look at the social contribution, the humor, the verve, you know, all of that stuff. Black Twitter made Twitter what it is. And it made it possible for us to find other ways of communication, which didn't require deep pockets, which, again, we, you know, is a barrier to us creating anything, any lasting impact, any sort of physical manifestations of our presence in this country or in this part of the world. So social media definitely, definitely helped create a space, create a safe space, and create a community. I've designed entire poetry workshops that only exist on social media, only through Twitter. You know,
yeah.
So I've used it as a source of income for myself and a way of creating communities. But the problem with it is, it's also becoming an increasingly hostile and volatile space, particularly for Black women.
Mm-hmm.
And as a man who's a brother to three sisters, who has a couple of, you know, nieces growing up, I'm increasingly aware of that. And also, though there is very little evidence of this right now, or it isn't shared liberally, these places are becoming, and slowly becoming to our detriment.
Mm-hmm.
It's affecting politics, is affecting our discourse, ability to hold our attention and create long-form engagement with each other, a deep, true understanding. And as always, I think the minorities will suffer this the most. So it's going to blow up in our faces in ways that are unpredictable right now. I think about, you know, the benefit it has brought to the Black Lives Movement,
mm-hmm.
but I think about mental health repercussions of viewing images of Black people in constant deepening horrific modes of distress.
Mm-hmm.
And another form of mental stress that will play out in our genes, which will be passed on to the generations that come after us. We only come to grips with the legacy of post-traumatic stress disorder and slave trade trauma, which is passed down through our genes. What would this do to us? You know, all of this is unquantifiable, and there isn't enough research. So I'm aware of the benefits it has to creating my voice, to creating space for me to find communities, to our communities, but there's something else coming, and we're not aware of it yet.
See, I think that's really interesting, though. So would you say, because I guess if we look at it in the broader context of like where we're at now, like so much stuff has pivoted to online. So you're getting so much more content online, which is like amazing if you couldn't access it that way. Like you said, kind of there's these huge discussions and debates that are being, I'd say, being held for the first time for a lot of people who are finally discovering, like, kind of, you know, that racism exists. But then on the other side, I mentor a lot of young girls, and they've said that they've had to put their phones down, put their phones away, take some time. And so I'm really interested in if you think there's almost going to be a split between this kind of always on massive consumption, all of the discussions happen online, and this kind of other way of just like back to basics, you know, storytelling in small groups, or like phone detoxes, or just like really, you know, you talked about meditation and being mindful and with your thoughts during this time. I'm interested in kind of which way you think it's going to go, or if you think it's going to be like a split.
I don't think it's going to be a split, but I think we need to develop better ways of managing this. And here's the thing, we shouldn't need social media to help us deal with racism. Right? We shouldn't need Facebook to share the stories of how the world is hostile to us. That should be evident. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be second-guessed. We shouldn't have to film our brothers being killed and to place it on media before political organizations and the government takes our word and believes us when we say this shit is happening. Like, none of that is normal here. And that shouldn't be the reason we use social media. Mm-hmm. We should use it as attention, as another mode of communication, as another way of being. Mm-hmm. But it shouldn't be required for survival. So I don't know. I don't think there will be a split, but I think that the world should be able to function without it, and the world will function better without it. We need to be in the same space as each other. We need to see each other breathing. We need to see each other crying, how our shoulders slope when we ask each other questions. All of that, is it something like 70% of communication is nonverbal? Mm-hmm. So what we get when we are on our phones is a modicum of what is truly meant, what is truly intended, which means in the grand scheme of things, then this creates deeper barriers between humanity. So we need to shorten that. We need to get rid of that, which requires us to be in the same space as each other. That trumps everything. Mm-hmm. That need for human physical connection, to be sat in a room, to experience something in real time, that collectiveness. This is why theater is such a sacred space, mm-hmm. which is why it must survive after this, to go back to sit in a room with 200-300, you know, thousands of people watching the same story. It's the closest we come to collective prayer, to communion, to villages, you know, mm-hmm. and life was much simpler back then. And there's something we've lost, I think.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree. I think it is really interesting because Jennifer and I have been talking about it. For her, it's like, you know, music festivals where she'll get that kind of natural yeah. high, and theatres. But, you know, that said, we're in a time where we don't know if they're going to reopen. And so it is interesting to me that it is possibly quite literally what the world needs the most at the moment, but it is something that is indefinitely on hold. So how do you, as someone specifically as a creative in that area, deal with like the kind of literally not getting to go to work, but then also knowing the bigger vision of what theatre does for people? How do you deal with this moment in time where essentially you're all kind of just being told to pause with no end date in sight?
The things we're doing, the basis of my work, or rather one of the primal seeds of my work as a poet and as a storyteller, is faith, the belief in the unknown, the belief in an imagined audience. When I'm writing the play, I'm imagining a room full of people listening to that play. It's almost an Afrofuturist endeavor to think of myself in the future whilst conjuring the past and the present, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, we just have to hope that the world will get back to normal and look towards that future. And that's what runs through most of the people in my industry. We can play this holding game where we do things digitally. Mm-hmm. But if theater occupies the same space as television and film, it will fail because television and film is developed and is suited for that medium. Mm-hmm. Whereas theater is in theater. You need to create space for magic to happen. No two shows are the same. Mm-hmm. And that's why people come to see a play over and over again, to see what happens when someone else is in that role, or what happens when you sit in this part of the theater and see something else. When you watch something on the screen, it's just the exact same thing. You play it over and over again. So we need space for chaos. And theater is the closest thing in terms of entertainment that we have to real life. You know, mm-hmm. we see people on stage playing out their truth, and then we have to reconcile how that truth affects us. So I think for my industry, largely we're just on hold, mm-hmm. waiting for the virus to dissipate so we can tell stories to people in real time again. Sharing things on Zoom, like I said, has its attractions, and I try to create moments of true interaction in my poetry performances. I run this event called a search party. Mm-hmm. And very simply, it's a poetry event where the audience choose the poems that I read or perform with them. All the poems I have ever written exist in this app called Scrivener, which exports text files into Dropbox, which I access with another app on my iPad. And the app I use on my iPad is called OneWriter, and it has a search function built into it. So I could type in specific words into that and find a poem that contains that word and read it to an audience. So when I give search parties and host them online, the audiences give me the words and I read them the corresponding poem, which means that there is a genuine interaction, and no search parties are the same, because it is determined by the word choices of the audience, which changes in every single search party. So this is one way for me to inject some of the chaos and the unpredictable nature of theater into the Zoom performances. But as much as it's fun and it's great, I need to be in a room with people again. I miss that.
I think we all definitely miss it. I'm interested as well, I know that I keep pushing it, but it's just because I'm fascinated by it, just in terms of the practicalities of it. You know, like, we've seen cinemas are very gently kind of rolling out, opening up again, but there is a very real, I think, realness, which I feel like, you know, I feel like you were alluding to a bit earlier when we were saying that we almost haven't seen the worst of it yet. You know, these are, you know, if you're in the creative industry, you're probably on a freelance contract, or you may have been furloughed, or that local theatre, you know, like if it's a local art centre, might not be reopening. And I've seen on your social, you've been retweeting any jobs that you could find, or any funds that were supporting people in the theatre. But is there a collective kind of plan, you know, if there isn't a higher governmental plan, is there a within the theatre industry plan to keep supporting or moving towards the gradual reopening cinemas have? I'm just wondering in practicalities, because I also think I have family members who live for the kind of pantomime season towards Christmas, and Hackney Empire, for example, always does a black pantomime, which I love, because it was the only place in London you could just see a black pantomime. But those things are very much you would plan your year around them, and you can't now. And I just wonder, partly because I'm thinking how do we really support? I just feel there's not enough top line level of support.
There definitely isn't, and it's a conversation we've been having since lockdown. There's a new campaign which we're trying to get off the ground called, what was the government one? It was Eat Something for the restaurants.
Oh yeah, Eat Up to Help Out.
Yeah, so the theatre industry are trying to start something called Seat Out to Help Out, where the government pays 10% of every theatre ticket across the country if they can. And the government for that, I don't know if they will be successful, but that's ongoing conversations and movements in my industry. But generally, the short answer is we don't know. A lot of careers will be decimated if this isn't over soon. And this is because theater is already a strapped for cash genre. Mm-hmm. All the time, we're working against incredibly tight budgets. Sometimes we're working with no budget, and people contribute the time for free, and they're just about to make ends meet by doing odd jobs. A lot of actors have part-time jobs of waiters and restaurants and doing, you know, other kinds of labor. And it's difficult. We don't know. There are a lot of nervous people in the industry. It's sometimes we think the coronavirus was specifically designed to destroy the theater industry, because it's the worst possible thing. You have to sit in rooms full of people with the doors closed in the dark, in close proximity for 2 to 3 hours, you know, at a time, one person sneezes and decimates the entire audience. You know, that's what we're facing right now. So we are not sure. We're looking at outdoor spaces for outdoor theater, which has its attractions, but also lighting and set design really helps the suspension of belief, which is required for theater.
Sure. There's also the British weather to contend with.
Exactly. Again, this isn't a great country for theatric performances. So the short answer is we don't know. The UK theatre industry and entertainment industry in general contributes a staggering amount of money to this country, which the Conservative governments don't value because it isn't what Conservative governments value. And we're trying to lobby them to care about us.
I want to switch gears a bit because of what we were talking about earlier about race, because prior to all of this kicking off, I would say there was just so much to go and see in terms of Black British talent. Like, it felt like to me the galleries were, you know, finally recognising amazing Black artists. Art prizes were going to people we'd never heard before, but like amazing Black British women. And, you know, like I had just seen Andrea Levy's Long Song and I was about to go and see Your Barbershop Chronicles, and then this all happened. But prior to that, it really felt like, I don't know, that there was just a real embracing of Black creative talent in like big spaces. And I wonder if you were starting to feel like the momentum was building beyond what can sometimes feel like a trend, which I hate because I'm just like, we're not a trend, but were you starting to feel that it was like there was like a big kind of movement happening?
Definitely. I think Barbershop Chronicles changed a bunch of things in the theater industry. The ideas on what theaters thought would be financially viable, would be successful, the risks in which they placed, and the fact that it sold out its two runs in London, then toured America for, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, went to Australia and New Zealand, and then they came back and sold 40,000 tickets at the Roundhouse, and then toured nationally as well. Like, it went far and beyond. And I think the theater industry woke up to that, to not think we were risks anymore. That it just needed to, you know, allow us to tell our stories in the ways we wanted to and get the hell out of the way. Mm-hmm. And I think about the theater blog Aphrodisiac, and the lady who started it said when she first began, she'd have maybe, you know, one or two plays a month to review. And now she has to have a team of reviewers constantly out. And sometimes there aren't enough people to go around to see all the Black plays. Mm-hmm. So definitely things had changed and were changing. And I just hope that when we go back, when theaters reopen again, that trend continues. Mm-hmm. There is a genuine fear among theater directors and artistic directors of venues that audiences might not be ready for anything too political or might just want traditional theater. And that would be a safe way of welcoming them back to the audience for throwing diverse work at them. And at the start of lockdown, I had one of my plays canceled because that was genuinely what the theater director believed.
Wow.
But when George Floyd died and Trump carried on with his bullshit, I think he realized that politics isn't going to change because of the coronavirus. That in fact, all they did was share more of, you know, the hidden ways in which racism kind of is manifest. And they put the work back on. Albeit it's been postponed for another 2 years because that's when he imagines theaters will be back up and running.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this fear and this conservatism which might creep back in if we don't watch it.
And do you think with that level of change that we were seeing before, did you notice, I'm just guessing, like from your kind of social media interaction or who you were seeing turn up to the plays, whether it was like a younger voice that was really leading that change, or do you think it was a response to like the appalling Windrush treatment, or, you know, were you seeing whole families from the grandmother to the, you know, teenager come to the place? I'm just interested in on what you think was like underlying that, or was it that the people for the first time got to see themselves on the stage? What do you think it was?
I think it was people for the first time getting to see themselves on stage, but also that their story is making national headlines, right? So Windrush generation, definitely. But that was plugged into the government's hostile immigration policy, which was plugged into Brexit, which divided families as well. So there were many entry points into discussing the Black experience and many spaces and theaters that were interested in those intricate conversations. So it was a mixture of everything. And definitely the Windrush generation and that upheaval caused many Caribbean families to suddenly look through their own histories mm-hmm. to understand, you know, immigration policies, where they came from, how they arrived here, which gave birth to other plays, and to look at, you know, the Windrush years and the legacy of that playing out across the United Kingdom. So I think it was a mixture of all of those things. Yeah.
Interesting. And talking of that, one of the things I noticed is that there's a campaign to put The Good Immigrant on the GCSE reading list. And so for readers who haven't read the book, The Good Immigrant was kind of crowdsourced from some amazing, diverse writing talent across the UK to talk about their experiences, kind of dual nationality of like being a person of colour in Britain and what that means. I absolutely loved it because it literally covers everything. It kind of doesn't feel like a history book. It's so very real. It's like people talking about their very real experiences of like going back to Caribbean or wherever with their families and what that's like, and how you kind of have to sometimes you kind of relax into your skin depending on what part of the world you're in. And it was just all these brilliant different types of views. It was like I really liked it from a female perspective of just like talking about like culturally like what kind of makeup and stuff is like in different communities, and then coming back to the UK and then like the idea of size, like in the Caribbean, like if you're bigger it's kind of great, and so you can go and they're like, oh, you're not eating enough, and they just pile more on your plate and it's wonderful. But it's a really great book, and it was crowdsourced with all these amazing writers, and then it did really well, and it was launched I think on this site called Unbound, which I found really interesting, where you basically see if there's demand for a book, and if there is it gets sold, and it was like a success story. And now everyone that's, you know, contributed and you included are pushing for it to be on the GCSE reading list. So what was your interest in both contributing in the first instance and then pushing for this campaign?
I was aware that there were conversations happening about the book because Nikesh Shukla, who started it, and Musa Kwonga, who challenged Nikesh to start it, are very good friends of mine. And when I heard this thing was going on, Nikesh didn't actually ask me if I'd like to contribute. I offered. I said, can I write an essay? Then I said, okay, send me some ideas. And then I did. So I sort of talked my way into it, really.
I like that.
And then I'm just so pleased that it did well. And it's just the book that keeps on giving, really, and helped us find a safe space to commune, to share. A lot of writers, their careers were launched, you know, with the book, alongside mm-hmm. the book, because of how well the book did. And regarding the campaign, I guess we just shared it across our social media platforms. I included it in our email outgoing saying, this is happening, please support, please sign the petition and see what happens. And I think it's still pending. Nothing has been decided just yet. And we just hope that it happens. We know the government refused to teach about the legacy of colonization. We know that they turned down that petition, which was signed by hundreds, thousands, I think millions of people even, which just shows, again, conservative government and the willingness to stay fixed and to remain tied to the past rather than look at the demands of the present population and creating a safe space for the future population. We know, for instance, that 32% of students in British classrooms are from BAME backgrounds. They're all mixed. Yet the government is refusing to create a safe space and to reflect the true legacy of the history of this country. And we just hope that the book can bring some of that nuance to discussions. We don't know if we're going to be successful, but we all want it to happen.
Yeah, I really like the TV show Blackish, and there's a scene in it where, again, they're talking about the US, and she's telling one of the young kids, like, just be aware of those history books, the history that they're taught and the history that was is actually kind of quite different. And I always find that really funny to watch, because it's like you are really denying a very vital part of history in terms of people understanding where they came from, in terms of understanding prejudice, in terms of understanding, I would even say, because I'm really interested at the moment in terms of money and equity, and like you really have to understand what that meant for like where we're at now in terms of, you know, who can have access to housing and who has wealth and generational wealth. All is fed on that. And so actually you do really need to teach this stuff so that people know.
Yeah, you really need to teach this stuff, yeah.
Okay, and so looking forward, so next month you have a new book of poems. Was this being written during the pandemic, or had you done it just before?
Yeah, I'd finished most of it last year. Mm-hmm. And we always intended to release it in October. Mm-hmm. So nothing has changed for us. I just got time to finally polish the book off. And the last poem I wrote in it is called Fuck Batman, which is about the coronavirus. So that final poem I wrote during lockdown, and that was the most difficult one, but that was the last piece of the puzzle. And yeah, I'm looking forward to getting it to readers and to see what they think about it. The book is intensely political, but also intensely personal. And the very first poem that I wrote was called Fuck 45, which is about the US president. And a friend of mine challenged me to write 45 poems that were similarly styled with similar momentum through the poem, similar structures and conceits. And very quickly, I decentered Trump because there was nowhere I was going to write a book about him. But I just wrote around the things that gave rise to the man he is and the parallels it has with the other men in this country and the ways in which they make spaces toxic and misuse power. So the book touches on all of that, but it's really broad ranging. It covers everything from climate change to Boko Haram, to classic Greek mythology, to barbershop culture, to Nestle and the exploitation and the boycott of Nestle, which carries on to this day because of their exploits on the continent, to motherhood, to gender politics. It really takes a close look at masculinity played out through Black communities. And there's a poem about Heath Ledger in it. Like, it's quite... it's quite
wow.
And also Will Smith and Men in Black. So it's kind of funny, very poignant. And it's 55 poems. The longest sequence in it is called Fuck Empire. And it's about Britain pillaging and destroying Benin City in order to get the Benin bronzes, many of which are still held by the British Museum, who refused to return it to Nigeria.
Mm. How do you envision the role, one, I guess, of the poet and the artist more generally as we head into this 2020 decade? I think Jennifer and I definitely wanted it to be hopeful. Like, we want to very much ask difficult questions and hold people to account and start thinking about things that had kind of been swept under the rug for a really long time. But also, we talked about why we love creative so much and the ability to just keep changing and innovating. And, you know, even when you talk there about, you know, like trying to make the Zoom versions of what you're doing as interactive as possible, what do you see the role of the creative is? And then also, how do we support the creative? Because the other thing Jennifer and I were saying, you know, the creative is sometimes a bit like a Black woman. We expect her always to come up with the results and innovate and change things, but we never pay her. And so, like, what are we doing there? So I guess, yeah, one, what do you think the role of the creative is? And then how do we support the creative, you know, financially, emotionally, to keep us hopeful, to keep us creative, to keep us inspired?
I think the role of poets haven't really changed since the art form was invented thousands and thousands of years ago. And I think different poets have different interpretations of what that role is or how much they can sacrifice in order to fully live out that role. But for me, the primary job of poetry and of a poet is to be a witness, is to say, this is the world. I was there. Look at it through this particular lens. It is to hold a mirror to humanity and say, this is who you are. What will you do about the reflection? And it isn't to become political to say, do this. It isn't become deductive to say, you know, this is how you have to do this. It's just to say, look, see, contend. I think that's it. And with my work, that's all I try to do. Just check out the world as I see it. Do you see it the same way? How does it make you feel? Weird, cool, I feel weird as well. Nothing, okay, that's not, you know, and that's, I think that's my primary job. And going forward now into 2020, in this really transitional period, or maybe this deepening political period, we have to do that more to find other ways to hold mirrors up to those we hope will find their reflections and then be moved to do something, whatever that is. And I think one way we can support poets and artists is not to pressure them to, like you said, to have answers or to come up with immediate answers. So much of the world is fast-paced, is heating up, is getting faster and faster, which means that it is a hostile place for true and good and great and lasting art. But art that doesn't feel disposable, that doesn't feel unfrequent, in order for it to have lasting legacies, it needs time. It needs to be pruned and preened. And time, especially when you live in the West, equates money. So a poet having a financial backing, a steady income to know that they're not stressed out because they might be thrown out of their flat or their domestic environment or food isn't coming, so they have to go and work in a construction site or something like that. Mm-hmm. Giving them space to create pure art is important because ultimately we will benefit from it more than they will. They suffer. We suffer to do this. And you guys only see the end product. You don't see the, you know, 8 years it takes us to write a novel. Mm-hmm. You just get to for a week. So sustained support for artists is what's required. And in America, they have a very different way of doing this. They have philanthropists who look actively for artists to support and to make sure they are well fed. Mm. You know, they give them Hollywood homes or their holiday homes to go there and write for months at a time. And in the UK, it's just very, very different. We don't really have that much support here. So the establishment of something like that would help, but also just pay artists their worth and learn to value their worth. Mm. Yeah, I think that's the most important thing.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. That was such an eye-opening discussion. So thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
That was a really informative and honest interview. Not only did Inuwa share some super insightful points about theatre and arts as a whole, but also the reality of being a creative prior to and during a pandemic, as well as the financial struggle of it all. And as much as it may be seen as simply another institution to some, the arts is a form of expression to many that allows for the depiction of real stories. And facilitating these stories are some really amazing talent in this space. I just wanted to quickly give a shout out to award-winning cultural producer, writer and social entrepreneur, Toby Kiaramatang. She is also the founder of the Black Ticket Project, an organisation that provides mentorship and discount access to London shows for young Black people. So thanks again to Inuwa for taking part in today's episode. Please make sure to follow and support his work. His details, along with links to what we've discussed, can be found in the show notes. So everyone, we've officially wrapped up the first season of The Culture is Black, hosted by me, Jennifer Adetoro. I want to thank everyone who has tuned in. I hope this was useful and offered a wide range of perspectives. For brands listening in, if you're serious about Black representation both internally and externally, then you really need to reflect on and confront whether or not you want to be a leading voice in issues consumers care about. If so, then you need to have more of these honest conversations. Ask difficult questions, expand your pool, don't go to the same five people for collaborations. Instead, find talent you believe in, invest in their work and amplify them. I also want to give a special thanks to Ariel Vetro, Carleen Thomas-Bailey, Lucinda Diamond, Sarah McCorkadell and the rest of the team at Cork for making this podcast happen. It's been a long journey, but it was an absolute pleasure being your host. And as always, if you liked today's episode, then make sure to get involved in the conversation and follow us for more information on Instagram at Cork Studio. We'll be back soon, but until then, take care and stay blessed.